Hello, I'm Elena Del Val, and this is the HispanicNPR.com podcast. My guests today are Sarah Sholkoff and Melissa Daniels, who are producers for the documentary Norita. We will discuss Norita. In addition to her work as a producer, Sarah is an academic whose research focuses on human rights and gender. Her doctorate investigated the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo and included field research with the group in the 1990s and 2000s. Sarah co-produced the 2021 documentary Ferguson Rising, which premiered at Tribeca. She founded Doctora Stories in 2022 to connect with creative voices and give voice to marginalized stories. She's a champion of Spanish language education in California and president of the Eileen and Fred Family Sholkoff Foundation. Melissa, with over 15 years in journalism and film production, is the founder and executive producer of Tidivity Studios. According to her bio, she is passionate about diverse narratives and creates commercial and original films merging social justice and authentic community representations. Notable projects include Nat Geo's 2023 release, The Mission, Hulu's Venus as a Boy from 2021, winner of a Tribeca International Film Festival Audience Award, and Apple Music's 2018 documentary, Rainbow, the film on pop music superstar Keisha. Sarah, Melissa, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
Let's start with a basic conflict of interest statement from each of you, if you don't mind. Who are you speaking for? What are your ties to this film?
I'll let Melissa go first.
I am one of the producers of the film, and my tie is just being very passionate about helping tell Norita's story.
I am also one of the producers for the film, and my tie is that I knew Nora nearly 30 years, and so it is a personal and professional project that I'm very enthusiastic about.
So here's an easy question. What exactly does a producer do in a film, and specifically in this film? Because sometimes when you have really large projects, there's a ton of producers, and then there's producers that are like executive producers, and they just kind of sign a check. And then there are producers that do a lot of legwork. So tell us a little bit about what a producer does and what a producers in this film have done.
That's a great question. Over the course of the project, we have a team of producers that has worked on this film. In particular, one of our directors, Jason McNamara, also sits in the producer's hat. He was the individual who started the project and really helped get it off the ground. So in that case, there's a multitude of things like crowdfunding, sourcing, connections with your subjects, building those relationships. And over the course of the project, that grew to expand another local producer in Argentina, Francisco Villa. And then Sarah got involved as well because of her connections with Nora. And so, like you said, producers do a multitude of different things, and it also depends on the timing of the project as well. I think early on, Sarah, you came in to support with some fundraising help with the project. Yeah. And just sort of jumped in with whatever Jason and his team needed at the time. And then over time, Sarah, because of her relationship with Nora, ended up forming her company in order to ensure that the back end paperwork and all of the story rights and things were secured and housed under one umbrella that had already quite a bit of pre-established trust with the family and the subjects. And in a situation when you're telling someone's story in this kind of caliber and this depth, it's really important to make sure that you're maintaining that relationship and keeping it in good standing with the family. Later on down the line, myself as a producer, I was introduced by a colleague to Sarah. We had a fun little evening out over a glass of wine, and she had told me about the story, and I had just offered up, if you ever need anything based on my background, having worked in the doc space, having had so many years of film production support, let me know if you need anything. And sure enough, she called me shortly thereafter. And so at the point that I came in the project, we had a loose rough cut that just didn't quite seem to be working. And so I kind of came in to help support with that next round of creative to really build out what this story was that we were going to be telling. And so there was a mix of writing support. There was a mix of logistics support. There was building a budget that we didn't really have yet and kind of building that out, helping support with our various vendors that you bring in on the post-production side, and really carrying that project through to the finish line. And now I'm focused mostly on festivals and distribution.
And I would add to that, the producer role for me evolved because, as Melissa said, I came in just knowing Nora, wanting to support the project, and over the process of 5 years, I went from, as you mentioned, executive producer who kind of helps perhaps use their time, treasure, or talent to get the project forward. And now I've been much more in the logistical side with Melissa, and actually helped initially with Jason McNamara's vision by giving him my dissertation. So he sort of said that helped him frame. And then Melissa's come in with a lot more of the business side of producing. And, but yes, I've secured funding. I've done fundraising screenings, and it's a good team effort because you need a lot of support for an independent film that is not studio backed, right? So it's been a really good process. And then Francisco Villa, our DP, director of photography and producer in Argentina, has been really having a heavy lift in the last few weeks because we are about to go to Argentina for the theatrical run for next week. And so everybody's got their kind of project, I guess is the best way to project, or their lane, and everybody's supporting each other. It's a good effort.
Let's go back to the subject of the documentary, which is, there's kind of like a small subject and a big subject in terms of the documentary is named for a person, but in the background, there is a period of history in Argentina that is almost a character in itself. Mm. Would you tell us a little bit about Nora Cortinas and this period of history?
Sure. I think I'll tackle that. So Nora was a very, very regular human being in the sense that she lived a life that was very typical for her age in the 70s. She married young. She came out of a non-political background. She had a side business as a seamstress. Her husband worked at the Ministry of Economy. They had 2 children. And, you know, it was very kind of middle class life in Buenos Aires. The thing was, at the time, worldwide, from the late 60s until the 70s, there was an explosion of activism for young people. And Nora's older son, Gustavo, really became part of that activism, right? In the film, you see him transform. His colleague, Antonia, says, you know, I saw him at work kind of curious. He'd always been this curious person, had a lot of questions, but then he wants to go with me to the slums of Buenos Aires and help the impoverished children. The systems weren't functioning. There was a huge underserved population in and around Buenos Aires, and it changed him. And he became more of a political activist. He married a woman who was politically active. And so for Nora, it was this revelation to see her son and confusion. And then the dictatorship, the worst dictatorship, because as we say in the movie, there are multiple coups in Argentina, but 1976 March was the most brutal. And people started to be disappeared. And that launched Nora into this completely different realm of space. She was very private and she became public, right? They literally went, the madres, the mothers, went to the most public space in Argentina to ask questions. And that was also very much of the time. If you think about the United States and the free speech movement and the anti-Vietnam protests and the Black Power movement and the EPA. So, you know, there's sort of this effervescence of young people all over the world. But Argentina, of course, slams that door on that whole process and becomes a murderous dictatorship.
How was the idea born? I know you spent some time with Nora and that you knew her personally. Tell us how you were able to reach that comfort level that we see in the film, where it's almost like the camera is not in the room sometimes.
I have to give, and I'm sure Melissa could illuminate this too, I have to give credit for both of our co-directors, Jason McNamara and Andrea Tortorese. They both established the relationship with Nora. Andrea had worked in the Madre's office for a number of years, so already knew Nora. Jason had done Messenger on a White Horse, which is another documentary, just 2 years prior. He was living in Argentina. He's from the journalistic and documentary space and archive producer. That's another type of producer we didn't discuss. And he was able to sort of, he describes it as wooing her to allow him into her world, because he identified with Andrea that she was a very specific and exciting figure to follow. I know many madres and they're all incredible in their activism, but Nora has this spark, right? She's just this combination of doer and laughing and enjoying life, but also very focused on getting the task done and supporting her community, supporting whatever the issue is at hand, and very has this incredible balance of that. So it's really Jason, Andrea starting the project, and then Nora told me about it when I was organizing a series of lectures for her in the Southern United States at universities. And she told me that they were making this movie. And I wanted to get involved because I also felt this, I had written about Nora in articles and, you know, had helped her come to the United States several times and accompanied her. So I wanted to, I said, of course we need a documentary about Nora. So that was my initial interest in the project. And I think the two of them had just established this incredible intimacy with her. Like, as you say, you get her at very, you know, putting on makeup, getting up in the morning, you see her in all of herself. It's really lovely.
Was she compensated financially to be in the film to allow access to her life?
No.
Were you going to say something, Melissa?
Yeah, I was just going to add a little bit of color. When Jason initially approached Nora, he had been working at an English-speaking newspaper in Buenos Aires called the Buenos Aires Herald. I know Sarah had mentioned that. And Jason has a huge heart for the queer community and had actually met Nora out at a march. So the start of this project really was so organic in meeting Nora exactly where she was. And I think that is really the beauty about who Nora is. It speaks volumes about her, and it also speaks volumes about how this project came to be. because he was able to build that relationship with her over time, having seen her out in the streets marching for various causes. And then Andrea, of course, working at the nonprofit alongside her. So I just wanted to add that little bit of color because I really think it speaks volumes, like I said, about who Nora was as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And Norita, of course, is the diminutive for Nora, in case any of our yes. listeners are confused.
That's right. Yeah. She was so Nora sadly passed at May 30th of this year, 2024, but I spent a lot of time with Nora and she was under 5 feet and you would not really realize that with the power and the just presence she had, but she was very tiny. So it's rather, and you know, as she says, they call me Norita.
Is she well known? I get the impression in watching the film that people on the streets, as she was be walking around for whatever particular reason, or it was part of a march, people would just come up to her and hug her and kiss her.
Yes.
Was this staged? Was this really no. what happens there?
That is literally, I can speak to this, sorry, Melissa, because sadly, Melissa never got to meet Norita, but we are going to make sure she gets some of the perspective going to Argentina in a few days. You would walk down the street, if she wore her pañuelo, her headkerchief, absolutely people would recognize her. But even without the pañuelo, as my husband says, it's like walking down the street with a rock star. People would stop her. People would want to hug her. People would want to thank her. She really is this figure that it's interesting that there had not been a very, you know, sort of important documentary done about her, but she didn't seek that either. So I think that's another, as Melissa added beautiful context and color to the last question, she was never seeking that. But yes, absolutely, everyone knew who she was. And when the minute she put on that pañuelo, people recognized her instantly.
How did you choose to zoom in, because she's not the only person, let me go back, she's not the only activist, she's not the only mother who was affected, sometimes deeply affected, that you featured in the film. How did you choose her and focus the laser, put the laser focus of the documentary on her?
Do you want to answer that, Melissa?
Sure. I mean, Nora was such a force within the community and became one of the most vocal mothers over the years of her life. And so I think obviously she carries our through line. Some of our secondary characters that you get to meet were very specifically chosen. Maria Ana Carriega, Nora's sort of a surrogate mother to her, because as you see in the film, Ana also lost her mother in the dictatorship. And Ana also provides, as does Nora Strahilevich, who we also hear from as a historian, but also a dictatorship survivor herself. Both Ana and Nora were disappeared themselves. And so their stories of what happened to them after they were kidnapped really helps Nora paint a picture of what happened to Gustavo, her son. And they clearly demonstrate, you know, what was going on, quote unquote, behind closed doors and in these concentration camps, essentially, where these people were being disappeared to, tortured, and then many of them were killed and murdered. And the unique thing about including the two of their voices, I'm speaking of Ana and Nora Strahilevich, is they became agents of terror, as you'll hear Nora call them. They became sort of this demonstration once they were released of what happens to people if they speak out against the government. And thankfully, neither one of them lost their lives, and we still have them here, and they're continuing their work across the globe. But we felt that those two people in particular were very instrumental in really helping round out what this experience actually looked like for people who were being disappeared. And then lastly, the other voice that we include She really comes in as this component of, she was a colleague of Gustavo's and
Antonia.
Yeah. Sorry. I didn't say her name, but Antonia was a colleague of Gustavo's. And so she was one of the people who took him to the slums and really helped expand his worldview in those early years of in his teen years. And that really helped open his eyes and shaped him into wanting to speak out and wanting to become active in this space. And ultimately that's what led him to, you know, be captured and disappeared. So those were our characters, and we really felt the between all of them, they really showcased a holistic approach of what happened during that time. And then additionally, you'll probably notice if you see the film, is that we chose to
female voices.
We really chose to only feature female voices. I think throughout history, we've had our history dictated to us throughout history, but through the male lens, through the patriarchal lens. And so this particular story with Nora at the center was an opportunity for us to say, this is the female experience through something so tragic, and a holistic female experience from a mother, from a survivor, from a colleague, all who experience this collective history. And so this was our opportunity to create a piece of art and create a story that really centered female voices.
I just wanted to add, it's very indicative of what the Madres were as a female-centered mothers movement that would then come to be defined as proto-feminist, because if you think about the juxtaposition between the dictatorship, which was very patriarchal, misogynistic, the maternal voice, and then other women's voices are really important to be heard.
What was the goal when all of you got together as a team and said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to raise the funds. We're going to make the time. We're going to embark on this project. What was the goal that you had in mind? If you could, is there a short version that you say, if we accomplished this, we accomplished our goal?
Well, I guess I'll speak to that. Essentially, I have always felt, you in the last question you asked, why Nora? Nora is a very unique figure in the Madres movement. She was, during the initial years of the Madres, she was the secretary. I think she reached treasurer. She became this important leader in the Madres movement. But beyond that, as a human being, she's just very fascinating and captivating. And so I have always wanted, as a friend and somebody who sees her as a mentor and a role model, I wanted her story to be told on a more international level. I wanted to have, so I taught for many, many years Spanish and Portuguese and language and literature. And what I found in the classroom is when I showed movies or documentaries, kids engaged in a far deeper way. So I think my pivot to not just writing about Nora has been, I wanted to impact people by her story. And what we found at all of these festivals and screenings, the LATAM, Latinx community really have no idea about this history. And it's really important because she represents activism. She represents activism in older women. She represents a female community. She represents empowerment of an individual to then help shift major issues in her own country. We haven't touched on the fact that her last big battle was to secure abortion rights in Argentina in 2020. She's, you know, the women of that movement adopt the Madres triangular white pañuelo and make it green. So the impact of her organization, but her specifically, is so tremendous, historic, that I really, that was my impetus to get involved and really push this movie as far as it can go so people could become educated about these incredibly important topics: authoritarianism, fascism, you know, all the important buzzwords of today, quite frankly.
I think the fact of the matter is, as well, Elena, is the fact that this history is not just unique to Argentina. We've seen this type of genocide all across the world. It's a history that Latin America shares. Many, many countries throughout all of Latin America have experienced these types of dictatorships who have then disappeared and murdered people. And sadly, we're seeing that happen now. And so this was an opportunity to share a story that is not just a opportunity to capture a moment in time, but to showcase the fact that history is continuing to repeat itself and it doesn't have to.
Do you see a parallel? Was it in the back of your mind with the political climate that we have, without going into politics specifically, but we have a situation here where on the edge of a vote, we have a country divided. Were the issues that we are facing here as a country, the divisions that we are experiencing, were they in the back of your mind? Was this part of the reason that you wanted the story to be known?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Personally, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Watching Nora in the film is thoughtful. The film stays with you, of course, which I imagine was part of what you were looking for. And it's certainly for me, I can say it was difficult to watch. But one of the things that stayed with me that as we're discussing it, I think about is that although, as you have described in our conversation, and as we can see in the documentary, she was iconic. She also was soft-spoken, and I don't know if the word polite is the best way. How would you describe her? It's not this firecracker at the top of her voice and raising her fist in the air. And I don't know if this is because we meet her toward the end of her life, but what was she like as you experienced her, this relationship that you had with her, Sarah?
I would disagree. I definitely think we see her at the, you know, the final moments of her incredible activism, right? Because they started filming Fran and Jason started filming in 2017. But what I remember about her is she did have a fire. She did have a presence. Yes, she also very specifically would talk to all politicians. Her comment always to me was, I do not abide by a party. I abide by, you know, changing politics. So she would talk to the left, the right, the in between. She was very specific about what she was going to support and for what reasons. And I have seen her get fiery and furious and passionate, but yes, she also knew diplomacy, I guess, is what you're sort of asking. Like her sister, I'm blanking on her lovely sister, Juanita. Juanita in the beginning says, you know, she was very coqueta. She was very flirtatious. She was flirtatious. She was so charming. My parents knew her pretty well. And I remember she hosted a wonderful barbecue for us in 1998. And she was so charming and lovely with my father, and in a very, you know, that sort of different era hospitality. And yet she could flip around and get really furious about something. And you see that as well in the film, where they're all standing in front of the government. I think they're standing maybe not in front of the Casa Rosada, but they're with a banner. And she's like, come down here, you cowards, cobardes. You know, she would not take no for an answer. So there's a duality to her. Absolutely. She knew how to manage different situations and when to turn on the fire and when to turn on the diplomacy is how I would say it.
She also could be very direct. In one scene when she talked about the church, There seems to be a lot of hurt there. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Do you want to take this, Melissa, or shall I?
Sure. I mean, if you watch the film, you understand this is a woman who is completely in anguish. She lost her child. So how you cannot feel like a deep sense of grief and how you cannot feel a deep sense of anger and desire to bring your child back home alive. And it wasn't just her child she was fighting for. Nora was a voice alongside all of the other mothers that who all wanted them, who all had lost children, to have their children returned alive. That was everything to them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, she says it in a moment in the movie that for her as a Catholic, it's a huge abuse that the Catholic priests would bless the military officials and the police to do this work of disappearance, torture, abuse, and murder. So, of course, I think she feels this betrayal. And it is, you know, maybe she never had a feeling about the military in that same way, but you do get the sense that this has been a huge, I don't remember her ever being particularly religious. There are other madres who are very religious, but Gustavo did work, her son did work in the slums with a very well-known liberation, Third World Liberation priest, Mujica. So I think I think you're very astute to see that sort of, you know, very direct conversation with the church when she's talking in the plaza and when she's talking at the pro-abortion rally in 2018, you know? So I think there is this sort of, I never actually asked her about that, but I think you've pinned it on the head that, you know, her son's work with this priest in the slums of Buenos Aires, he was murdered, that priest, I'm forgetting his first name, but his last name is Mujica. And then, you know, Gustavo, and as Melissa said, a whole generation of activists were also murdered and disappeared.
Well, and in addition, of course, it's an Argentinian who sits in the Vatican today.
Yes.
This must be something, because he would have been in Argentina at the time these events took place.
He was. He actually, this is a very interesting side story. So Ana Cariaga, who is the woman who becomes sort of the surrogate child for Nora Cortinas, who was disappeared and pregnant when she was disappeared, her mother, who was one of the founding mothers and was also disappeared, was Pope Francis's boss in a laboratory in Buenos Aires in the 70s, before Pope Francis then became part of the seminary and an educator. So there's an intimate connection there. And somebody asked us at Austin, our screening on Monday, if Nora had ever spoken to the Pope. And I don't know that answer, but it wouldn't surprise me that she knew him. And I have always felt like the Pope has been respectful of the Argentine dictatorship and not a denier of it, because his beloved boss was disappeared by the dictatorship, and he knew others. There's a really good Argentine filmed movie called Yo Francis. You can find it on Netflix, and it's basically a biopic about his life in Argentina and what leads him to be, you know, the sort of different pope that we have. I feel like he's a different pope.
Different in what way?
I mean, he's more aligned with people of different backgrounds. He's made statements. You know, he comes to me across as somebody who's more concerned about the oppressed. And I haven't read specifically comments about his feelings about the dictatorship, but I know through other channels that he was very concerned about the dictatorship, because as I already said, he had intimate friends and colleagues who'd been disappeared.
different perhaps as in contrast with the previous post.
Yes, I don't want to get into like my, but yes, exactly. I think he has a more, at least with Argentina, he has a more holistic view of what happened in his country and deeply understands the trauma that the entire country went through with the dictatorship and the policy of disappearance.
The woman, one of the two that was disappeared, her testimony, which you show in part in the documentary, was also very enlightening, very human is the word that I'm finding. What, tell us a little bit about her. That seemed like a really impossible experience, life experience that she has had, and yet she seems to have managed to get through it and to be able to tell her story with composure.
Are you speaking about Ana Cardiaga, the long-haired woman who talks about her torture experience?
Yes, the one who was pregnant when she was incarcerated.
So Ana Cardiaga, sorry, Melissa, I'm taking this one. Ana Cardiaga definitely has a perspective because she has also become a social psychologist. So she's a therapist by training and very deeply intelligent, and I think has an ability to speak about these horrors in a way that doesn't immediately make a viewer or a listener or an interviewer be put off by what she's saying. She has a very intelligent way of describing it. She's written about things. She has a radio show that I actually got to visit with our other director, Andrea, while I was there for the Argentine premiere of the movie in September. And I think she spent her life trying to articulate what it is to be a survivor. And so has Nora Strahilevich. She has written, she's actually a former literature professor in the United States at the University of San Diego, and she's written multiple books about it. So I think for these survivors of these concentration camps, many of them have turned to art or professions that allow them to, you know, rework these really awful experiences. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, thank you. How have the Argentinian people that you have interacted with in the making of the film and in the showing of the film, what is their reaction? Because sometimes we live through times and we're not always aware of everything that's happening. When we see things in retrospect, they can seem very different.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'll speak to this again. Sorry, Melissa, since she is now going to Argentina next week. So the country itself has gone through a complete re-envisioning of the dictatorship. When the Madres were in existence, people, of course, when they initiated their organization, people were terrified. As Melissa already says, this idea of agents of terror that the dictatorship created by allowing certain members of or certain folks to get out of the concentration camps, they then disseminated terror in the population. So by the mid-80s, with the trials that were happening of the main officers in the dictatorship with the constitutionally elected government of Raul Alfonsín, people were talking about it. The document that was produced from those trials was a countrywide bestseller. It was called Nunca Más, or Never Again. When the 90s began, I was there, and people sort of wanted to forget about the disappearances because you see him briefly, President Menem pardoned those generals and chiefs of police. So I think the country, and, you know, Astiz, Alfredo Astiz, who is the infiltrator of the Madres, who's also in the movie, was running around going to, you know, discotheques, and everybody knew that. So the 2000s, when they basically started to find legal ways to go after the second and third and fourth in command, as well as saying that the illegal adoption of children of disappeared. So that was a horribly brutal tactic the dictatorship used. They would have these pregnant women or families disappeared, and they would adopt those babies to other people in the military or friends of the military and police. So the society at the end of the 90s through the 2000s up to the 2010s were going through a series of trials. And so people started to talk about the whole dictatorship in a very different way, there's legal reason we can be more accepting of what the Madres were saying, right? We have the courts have changed the laws, the government, the Senate and the House of Representatives have changed the laws. So at this point, we're seeing, sadly, with the current president, Javier Milei, who is saying, well, there weren't that many disappearances and it wasn't that bad. And people in his cabinet have actually gone to visit Alfredo Astiz, the infiltrator of the Madres. And so it's as if the pendulum has swung back slightly towards people wanting to say, oh, these were mothers of terrorists, which is what the military said in this 70s and 80s against the Madres. And it's, I think generally the population knows what happens in the dictatorship, are very moved. From every screening I've been to in Argentina, people are very moved by this. It's a beautiful story that that specifically, I'm going to give a lot of credit to Melissa, who came in at the end and helped us hone this incredible vast archive and multitudinal generation story into something much more streamlined. But yeah, I think there are a lot of young people who have no idea about this history, even though it is taught in schools. But that's why this movie is so fundamental to come out in Argentina next week as well.
How have audiences in the U.S., because you're already screening it in the U.S., how are people reacting? Is there awareness, incredulity? What are you observing?
Melissa.
Yeah, I mean, the response has been incredible. We've gotten a lot of support from folks. And, you know, anytime we've screened at a festival so far, we always have such an incredibly lively Q&A at the end where people are really interested in asking questions. You know, a lot of folks here in the United States didn't know about this history or weren't aware of this history, or maybe had a very loose understanding of who the Madres were. Maybe they had heard about them, but didn't really know what their story was. And so there's a very clear piece and component of education here that this film brings to various audiences. And then especially in the United States, because of our political climate here, there's been a lot of folks just saying, you know, we really need to get this film out. Everybody needs to see this film. It's so relevant to what's happening in the here and now, not just from in the 70s, but we're seeing, like I said earlier, history's repeating itself. And yeah. So it's been really wonderful to, you know, hear such positive responses from folks on how they're receiving the film. You know, like you said earlier, Elena, it is heavy to watch. There's no doubt around it. This is a very heavy history. But throughout that, you're also being inspired. And I think that was one of the biggest things that I personally have taken away from our experience in screening so far, is just the inspiration that Nora leaves with everyone. She really was such an incredible voice to activate a community and a global generation of women. We're seeing these this piece of ancestral feminism in what the Madres did during the 70s. And it's very encouraging to those of us that are continuing to speak out in our own communities worldwide, and especially here in the US, based on our own political climates.
The film showcases interviews and animation and archival videos and photos. How did you decide the balance, and how much effort did it take to put that story together in the way that you did?
You know, our director, Jason, is actually an archive producer by trade. So he has done a ton of work in that space and knows exactly where to find all the goodies. And so this particular film, from an archive perspective, there was so much archive to pull from. And so when it came down to the final edit, we were changing archive shots until the bitter end. You know, there's always something that you want to try and squeeze in that really helps tell this story. And so, you know, I'd say Jason did a phenomenal job with the archive. He really helped ensure that we had pieces of archive that really put you in the mix of what was happening, and you really feel like you're experiencing this firsthand. He was very selective on the choices of shots that we included. Some of it's easy to watch, some of it's well shot, and then other pieces aren't. Other pieces you really feel a bit jostled around, and that was intentional. Those choices were intentional because we really wanted to give viewers an opportunity to kind of evoke some of the fear and some of the chaos that was alive and well at the time. And then you also mentioned the animation. The animation was the brainchild of our other co-director, Andrea, who just did such an incredible job with these pieces. We felt that it was really important to have some kind of storytelling mechanism that allowed us to kind of soften how horrific this time was and really help foster that emotional journey that we see Nora go on. And that the animation really achieves that.
The music was done by Nora's friend and Academy Award winning composer Gustavo Santaolalla and his team. And he gave me and Jason excerpts of the music early on. And it was, I think, in some ways, the edits were so well done around those pieces of music. You know, he had a theme for Nora. He had a theme for the military. He had these other, you know, beautiful pieces in between of the family. And he thought about what he had seen with the footage, but also just knowing her and her personal story. So it really was an incredible editing effort to put all of the documentary archival footage, all of the live shot footage. What is it called, Melissa? I'm not remembering my vocabulary. The things that they shot of Nora in the marches in her house and other interviews. And then this beautiful animation that I think really takes the whole piece to another place. It's much, I've seen many hundreds of documentaries about Argentina, and that animation piece and the music really, as Melissa says, softens it, invites in the viewer, makes it much more accessible.
And at the same time, sometimes what you imagine is worse than the truth, although in this case, it seems hard to believe. 7 years, is that about right? The duration of the project from filming, which you said began in 2017 to this year?
Yes, that is correct.
Or, I'm sorry, you said you screened it in September. Was it this year or last year?
We had our premiere this past June in Los Angeles at the Dances with Films Festival. We had completed majority of posts just shortly before that.
Okay.
But there are opportunities for us to do early screenings with groups to secure feedback and just see how as we are going through our own editing process, which lasted, you know, a good chunk of 2 years, how audiences are responding to that, and we can take that into consideration before we lock the final project. But we did premiere this past June.
So, to give or take about 7 years, what kind of budget did that require?
Without getting into the nitty-gritty, these types of projects, it really depends on the type of support that you have from your financiers, potentially from distributors. This particular project was an independent film, so it is not a large budget, but we were very gracious to accept support from our incredible executive producing team, and that has been just instrumental. So I have to just give a quick shout out to Barbara and Andy Muschietti, who are also Argentine filmmakers here in Hollywood, and Avi and Naomi Lewis, journalists from Vancouver, who have
been
instrumental in really helping us shape the story. And of course, Gustavo Santaolalla, Sarah spoke of him earlier. He was our composer, and he really gifted his talents to this film. So we are so, so grateful. And then of course, to have, a name like Jane Fonda attached to this film as well, someone who is just an incredible feminist and activist in her own right, also support what we're doing here.
And I need to name John Flynn, who is we work together in philanthropy in San Francisco, and he came on very early to support the movie with his family foundation. So time, treasure, talent is what we have gotten from our incredible EPs and just a whole slew of organizations, individuals who wanted to support this project. And what I found very exciting is we are with Film Independent, so we have a fiscal sponsor and people can donate to the project. And we have gotten many donations over the years. We also did a crowdfunding initial source of generating funds. That was in 2018, and that's when I came on board to help with the crowdfunding. So in the credits, you can see a huge number of thanks to all of those individuals, because there's just been such goodwill. And as Melissa says, it is an independently funded project. Therefore, we are doing this with our resources and our blood, sweat, and tears.
Okay, let's look at it this way. Under a million, between 1 and 5 million, 5 and 10 million, where would you say that in cash and in kind was the budget?
I'm not sure that's something we feel fully comfortable answering, but it was definitely on the lower end of the scale. I will say that much.
Under a million?
Yes, under $1 million.
Okay.
Yes, under a million. It's one of these complicated questions, only in that you don't want people to assume that it's not valuable, right? If we're thinking about the marketplace, we want people to see the maximum output of incredible talent and effort and time and professionalism, and we want to promote that in the independent film space. Anyways, that's a deeper conversation. So that's why we're a bit reticent.
When you look at the end result that these women and their children, in some cases, the babies that were disappeared, the daughter of the woman that is interviewed, who she says is the reason she stayed alive because she was pregnant. All of these events that transpired in this period that you shine a light on in the documentary, the end result is that these perpetrators, these men who were holding the control buttons for a long time, and you were saying now that even the current president is sort of saying this wasn't really that important. Are we doomed to repeat history? Did all of this activism, let me try to summarize my question, did all of the activism that Nora engaged in, that you have so lovingly portrayed in the documentary, did it make a difference in the end?
I think yes. As I already stated, the society that I saw in 1995 when I first went to Buenos Aires and worked with Nora and her organization, Línea Fundadora, Madres de la Plaza, Línea Fundadora, is completely different. It is knowing of its past. It has reconciled with its past. It has discussed its past. I remember in 2005, 2006, in one of the main telenovelas in the country, there was a character who turned out to be the daughter of disappeared people. This is on a national stage. When you have that conversation in mass culture, it changes people's opinions. What I think we need to be very vigilant about is to remind the younger generations who were born, you know, two decades after the dictatorship, what the dictatorship was. And I think it was absolutely, I mean, these generals and these military officers and these police officers are still in jail. So that's a win. The rights of women in Argentina have been secured for abortion. That's a win. People all over the world have at least heard about the Madres, maybe not, as Melissa mentioned, maybe not to the extent that, of course, we're presenting, but it is a trigger in many of their memories of Spanish classes or history classes or whatever. And I absolutely think it is all for the betterment of the country, and if not the country, also the world, what they did. They have been emulated. We kind of touch on that. Their activism has been emulated all over the world. So yes, I guess if you're going to put it in, you know, sport terminology, it's a win, but I think it's so powerful too, and it's touched so many people. So yes.
Do you see a similarity with the very famous South African Truth and Reconciliation?
So that is an interesting question. That was happening in Argentina while I was working with the Madres in the late 90s. And for many of the human rights community, they understood why South Africa did a truth and reconciliation, conversation. They weren't really trials. They were sort of conversations, as I understand it. And what Nora, the Madres, other human rights groups, the people who had been disappeared really wanted in Argentina was justice. For most of the 90s and early 2000s, before the trials against, you know, Videla and all of the dictators and officers happened, was truth and justice. They wanted the truth and they wanted justice. So it wasn't just let's talk about what happened. They wanted people behind bars and to pay for their crimes.
In today's Argentina, where inflation has reached, I think I saw in the news the other day, 200% this year, and people are struggling with their own economic crisis, does this resonate? Is this just beyond their ken? What do you think it's going to mean? Is this something that's going to take decades?
The economic crisis?
The role of the film for the society today that is undergoing such a radical change under the new government, where people are having to deal with 200% inflation. We're complaining about our inflation. I can't even comprehend what it must be like to have 200% inflation.
I'll tell a story about that. So first of all, you have to understand Argentina has had a lot of activism in the last few months regarding the austerity measures and taking away public funding. The universities, over 100 universities, were taken over by students because the government was threatening to eliminate funding to these public and free universities. So that's a legacy of activism. I lived with a family in Argentina when I first was there in 95, and the daughter of my señora, my, you know, host mom, was never very political. I guess she was briefly in the 70s, but of course the terror that she might be taken by the military dictatorship eliminated that fervor. She is going to the jubilados, the retirees marches, basically every week, and they have become violent. The police have fired tear gas onto these marches. These are retired people marching for better pensions, right? They because of the inflation, their pensions don't reach what they can access in the market or in for, you know, gas and heat and all the basics you have to survive. And these are people who've worked their whole lives and are not getting what they need to pay their bills. And she's in the marches. So I think this movie will just activate even more passion to, you know, there have been huge protests all over the country about these cost-cutting measures. And yes, I understand that the inflation needs to get under control, but you can't provide services to people and then absolutely take them away, because that's how the country has functioned with these, you know, public services, public education, public health. So I think this movie, I'm really thrilled to see how it I think it'll galvanize people to be even more vocal and active and try to change things, because that's another beautiful legacy of this film. Nora says it again and again. You just have to keep going. You just have to keep struggling. You just have to keep working, because you will find an answer somehow with community, with collectivity, with justice in her case. But, you know, I think it's really important.
Did Nora feel that she had found a form of justice? Obviously, she kept going throughout all those years, it seems, until she passed away this year. Did she feel that she had found some kind of justice?
I mean, I think that's hard to answer. I think Nora is the only one who could truly answer that. But I would surmise, perhaps, that no. While, yes, she did help ensure that all of these people were put in jail and locked up in prison, she never got her son back, nor was she ever told exactly what happened to him, what his fate was. And I think I can only imagine, not being a mother myself, but, you know, having siblings and family, if I never received that answer, that would weigh on me in a way that I don't know that many people can comprehend unless you've gone through something like that.
Yeah. Thank you, Melissa. I would agree that I don't know if, knowing Nora, she ever, one of the things she said towards the end of her life often was, they need to open up the archives. The you know, government needs to open up the archives of what happened to our family members and children. We need to know the truth. By the way, we were talking about the Pope earlier. He said the same thing, that the government needed to open up the archives about the disappeared. I found it in an article I was looking at while we were talking about that. So this call for information is also something that she never got to see. And of course, she never found out the final destiny of her son. So, but at the same time, one can look at her life story and find joy in the journey and good results in the journey. And I think you know, I wasn't with her on her final moments, but I think hopefully she felt gratified by all of this incredible work she did towards changing her country's understanding of what the dictatorship was.
Did she die of natural causes?
Basically, yes. She had a series of health issues, and slowly, she was 94. So at the same token, she had an incredibly rich life. She spent 47 years of her life fighting for her son's memory and for justice. So, yeah.
How did she manage financially? Because she was dedicating herself full time to this activism.
Oh, okay. So she received her husband's pension. You know, he was employee of the state for decades. The Madres were a not-for-profit organization, but in her elder years, they did help the mothers. They've been able to help the mothers with sort of basic expenses in their kind of a pension, if you will, for their work for decades of activism in the organization. And I think, you know, Nora was able, she wasn't compensated when she traveled or gave lectures or any of those kind of activities. Always the lodging and the airplane fares or train or however she was going to get there were compensated by the organization bringing her. But, you know, she did not die a financially well-off person. And I think it was through her husband's pension. So that's basically how she was able. And she did have that side business of the seamstress work. But obviously that sort of went away once she dedicated herself full-time to the finding of Gustavo and what happened to him.
Where can our listeners find the film?
Great question. We are on the festival circuit. So we have been screening at various festivals in the United States and in Argentina. We will continue that for the near future. And I will let Melissa describe if she has a minute, or did she already get off the call?
We're working on distribution right now. So as Sarah mentioned, we're going to continue to push this story forward across the festival circuit. That's sort of a very organic journey for an independent film like this. And, you know, if you'd like to keep in touch in terms of where you might be able to see the film in the States, follow us on Instagram. We are at Norita Film, and we are also on Facebook, Norita.film. Those are the best ways to keep in touch with what's happening with the project and where you'll be able to see it. We don't currently have a secure distribution, but we are working hard. And if you happen to follow us on social and we are at a festival in your area, please come join us. We would love to see you.
Definitely. And also, if you're in Argentina next week, you can see it theatrically in theaters, but that might be harder for your listeners.
Right. Not sure how many people are listening to us in Argentina. Where in the U.S.? You mentioned the film circuit.
Yeah, so we're trying to find out from a couple different festivals. We just finished screening at the Austin Film Festival, where we were nominated for a jury award. But we don't currently have any other festivals booked. We are waiting. These are all on a rolling basis, but we'll continue that journey over the course of the next couple months. So please follow us on socials. We would love to stay in touch with you that way.
Sarah and Melissa, thank you for joining us from Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Thank you so much.
And to our audience, you have been listening to Sarah Schoelkoff and Melissa Daniels, who are producers of Norita, a documentary, who discussed the film. To propose a guest for the show, you can email me directly at editor@hispanicmpr.com. That's editor@hispanicmpr.com.